Most parents say that they do not enjoy the Common Core math. And whether you're good at math or whether you're not good at math, you know when it's working for your kid and when it's not. But the question is, why is it that we keep running into these same sets of problems with math over the last 10 or 20 years?
The Family Freedom Podcast, voices of family and freedom. Now here's your host, Wendy Hart.
Today I am joined by Barry Gorelick. He majored in mathematics, attended the University of Michigan, worked in an environmental field, both private and public, and did a six-month assignment in a Democrat Senator Wyden's office from Oregon, where he did research on mathematics education. Basically this question, why do we keep not being able to teach math? And after retiring, he obtained an education credential so that he could teach math and is currently teaching 7th and 8th grade math at a small Catholic school in California. So welcome, Barry. I'm excited to have you.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
The first thing that I ever read from you is this quote, which I absolutely love, probably because I relate to it. And you said, "Hell hath no fury like a mathematician whose child has been scorned by an education system that refuses to know better." There's a story behind that you can just tell. Why don't you tell me about it?
Yeah, and that was from the very first article that I wrote on math education that was published in Education Next. It was back in 2005 and was very well received, and I think for the reasons that you're displaying, it really resonated with a lot of parents. And that particular quote, in the article, I had talked with a variety of mathematicians, math professors whose children were being taught in ways that were horrifying to these people. And that's where that quote came from. As far as my experience, although I majored in math, I can't call myself a mathematician. I don't have a PhD in it. I don't do research in it. But nevertheless, I have some grounding in it. And I, too, was horrified when I saw how my daughter was being taught math. And I think a lot of parents go through the same thing, whether they're mathematicians or not. It kind of goes against how they learned it, and they don't understand why it's being taught in this odd way. And not only that, their kids are getting profoundly confused and frustrated. So that's where it comes from. As far as the education system not doing anything and letting it continue, that's an old story.
Well, I think we want to get into that, because I'm like you. I mean, I have a bachelor's in math, so I'm not technically a mathematician, but I've been watching this, you know, with my kids. And actually, when I was first working, you know, post college in a tech industry, the people that I worked with would come to me to have me help their kids with math, and they were frustrated back in the, you know, 2000s about it. Why is it that we keep doing the same thing and expecting different results from my perspective? Where does this come from?
Well, it's an old story. And if you go back to old math books, of which I have a pretty big collection, thanks to the internet, and you read the introductions to these books, they all sound the same. Whether you're reading a book from the 20s or the 30s or the 60s or the 80s or even now, it sounds the same refrain of, we need to teach math with understanding. And previously it has been taught with rote memorization, and we want to get away from that. We want kids to understand what they're doing in math. And this has been going on for like a century.
Wow.
Maybe even more. We could probably even trace it back to Euclid. there's always a disparagement of what came before, and now here's our new book, and this is really the new way.
And it's going to fix everything, right?
Yeah, this is going to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the irony is that when you look at these old math texts that supposedly didn't do the job, and I have the ones that I used in school and then the ones that came before me, it certainly is not the case that it was rote, that you just learned a procedure and you didn't learn the context or the conceptual underpinning. There were explanations of what was going on. what you were doing when you were carrying the one or borrowing. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
We don't use those terms anymore. We use regrouping. But the explanations were there. They were pretty successful, all in all. And if you compare maybe 30 years ago or more, the entering class to high school, entering freshman, to the entering freshman class now, you'd see that the ones 30 years ago or more had pretty good proficiency with decimals, fractions, and percents. Fairly good.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew the math facts fairly well. Compare that to the entering class now, where they're really faltering with the decimals, fractions, percents, and math facts, mm-hmm. and rely heavily on calculators. So there's a big, big difference.
Right.
I think the big change came, I don't want to go too much into the history. There was the new math of the 60s, if you recall that, because of Sputnik. Everyone got panicked. Oh, the Russians are going to beat us.
Right.
We have to up our math and science game. And overnight, there was all this funding, and the new math came into being. New math was very theoretical, very set theory embedded. And although there were good aspects to it, and the program was put together by a lot of good mathematicians, it was a little too formal for it to really take hold, particularly for the lower grades.
Mm-hmm.
High school, actually, some of those texts were pretty good. That kind of went on for 10 years, and then we went to this back-to-basics approach.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we really need the basics. Somewhere along the line, about late 80s, this organization, MCTM, National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, came up with their own set of standards. And that kind of lit the way into this kind of reform math movement. This movement had been going on for a long time,
mm-hmm.
but this kind of crystallized it. So we have to get away from the pencil and paper calculations and this rote memorization, you know, the typical mischaracterizations, the disparagement of what came before. And we really have to teach understanding. Kids really have to learn what's going on behind the doing. Let's put mm-hmm. it that way.
Right. Well, that's been the disparagement that I've seen, is that it's always this complete dichotomy. It's either drill and kill, and you just want kids to memorize without understanding. They're just robots, or they have deeper understanding. When I brought it up in my kids' elementary school, it was disparaged as drill and kill. And yet I was the only person there that had a math degree. And that's how I learned. And I felt like that drilling, although yes, that, you know, my mom can attest that I was not a fan of the drilling
right.
in third grade, but that allowed me greater understanding. So when you talk about kids not understanding fractions, well, if they don't know just innately that there's a relationship between 4 and 8 and 3 and 6, if they have to put that into a calculator, they don't see the patterns in math. Math is all about seeing patterns. And if you don't have that baseline, how do you see the patterns?
Well, that's correct. And I think also there's this tendency to make it black and white and mischaracterize mm-hmm. and say, well, it was all drill and kill and all rote memorization. And I'm sure that even though you may not have liked the drill, and neither did I, still, it wasn't all drill and it wasn't all rote. I mean, there was some explanation, and it's an iterative process, and this is what they forget or neglect to mention, that there's a back and forth tandem relationship between procedures and understanding. And you may not understand exactly the concept behind it, even though it's taught. I mean, I teach certain concepts like invert and multiply.
Mm-hmm.
In an algebra class, I feel they have enough tools that we could really understand here's why it works.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had really bright students, and I explain it. They still can't reproduce what I just did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because they lack intelligence. It's just still foreign.
Right.
Let me get into this a little bit. There's a spectrum of novice versus expert, and there are levels of understanding. And we're not born experts.
Right.
We're born as novices, and we learn in different ways than an expert might. And so it's a gradual accumulation of knowledge. I would bet in about a year's time, after I've taught these students this algebraic method showing why the invert and multiply works, that they'll probably be able to reproduce it. And to tell you the truth, I didn't, even though I majored in math, I didn't really know it until about 10 years ago. I was kind of curious. And, oh, that's how it works. Well, now I've got about 50 years experience. And so my adult accumulation of knowledge kicked in. I was able to understand it a lot easier than somebody who's 13 or 14 years old.
Right.
Because I'm further along on the expert spectrum than a kid who's just learning it. So I think that's what's going on.
Well, and the people making these decisions have arguably had that background information, and now they're at a position where they can go, oh, that understanding makes sense. But if you were in third grade or fourth grade, you wouldn't have had that. You know, they don't have adult brains yet, right?
Right, right. And I've heard adults say, gee, if only I had learned it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
me too.
If it had been taught that way, you wouldn't have learned it.
Exactly, exactly. We've dealt with the phonics issue, right? You know, whole language versus phonics. You and I, when we read cat, we just see the word. But that's because right. We have that experience. But when we first start learning to read, you sound out every word, and that develops those neural pathways in the brain.
Yeah, there's certain things, and I can't talk knowledgeably about the brain structure and how mm-hmm. it grows, but I can say that there is an accumulation of knowledge
mm-hmm.
That a 24-year-old is going to have that the 8-year-old is not, and we build on that knowledge. So the 24-year-old is able to use his tools a lot more efficiently than someone who's just learning them.
And so their process is going to be completely different.
Right, exactly right.
But is there something else more foundational? Why do we keep adopting these same kinds of programs that are touting understanding without focusing on being able to do the times tables?
I think it's just this ideology that has grown over past 100 years or so, maybe starting with Dewey and this whole idea of the whole child, and we have to teach understanding, and this whole idea that you could learn habits of mind, you could learn how to think without knowing the facts. I mean, that's really kind of where it's coming from. And I can't speak to the history of where this this philosophy came from, but it has evolved and inundated the education schools. So that now, if you go to ed school, you're going to learn these ways of thought that, oh, well, yeah, you don't want to drill and kill, and you don't want to explicitly teach. You want the kids to discover certain things on their own. And this whole ideology is embedded in the ed school structure so that new teachers coming out think this way. And they're not presented with any information, at least not in ed school, to the contrary. And there's a kind of a lack of research, which is starting to, fortunately, it's being filled in. There's a lot of research going on now, providing evidence of what are effective practices and what are ineffective practices. And I can tell you that that isn't being taught in the ed schools. What is being taught are papers that I guess they're peer-reviewed, but the peers are somewhat questionable. It's not very good research.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have things like learning styles, you know, kinesthetic learners and auditory learners and things like that, even though this has been debunked and there's research showing, no, that really isn't the case here. It's still, people think that way. And you can mm-hmm. hear teachers, I hear teachers all the time talking, oh, well, he's a kinesthetic learner.
Right.
Things like that. It's just inundated in the system that produces the teachers. And if you come up and criticize it, you're one of those.
Right, right.
You're not part of that system. And ironically, there are probably more than a few teachers who think like you and I,
mm-hmm.
and who teach in a traditional manner.
Right.
And yet, and even though I know better, I still feel guilty teaching that way.
Really? Wow.
As if I'm doing something wrong. And I've talked to other teachers who say, yeah, yeah, I have that same feeling. I mean, we don't stop teaching in the traditional manner, but I have this feeling like, yeah, you know, if somebody came and saw me doing this, I'd really be in trouble. But
And you're in a private school, and parents are paying to have that.
Yeah, and in the private school, I would say even in public schools, most teachers will rely on direct teaching ultimately. What has also happened is, particularly in the lower grades, the textbooks that have now come out are geared to this type of thinking, to this ideology.
Mm-hmm. If you have a textbook at all.
Well, that's the key. Sometimes they just give you a workbook and mm-hmm. things like that. And James had alluded to this mm-hmm. in your podcast with him, mm-hmm. James Wilson, that he said, yeah, they teach the alternative ways of or strategies for adding, subtracting, you know, multi-digit, addition, subtraction, division, multiplication. And it isn't until later that they learn the standard algorithm. It's kind of backwards. So even if the teacher might want to teach the standard algorithm, they're told, no, you got to go by this textbook, depending on the school. But no, you got to go by what's in this textbook. The parents who want to teach the kids, well, this is the way I learned it, and this is the way you should do it. Sometimes there's notes written by teachers, and I have some of those that I saved because I found them on the internet, that please don't teach your child the standard algorithm. We're doing it a certain way, and this will disrupt the process, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually getting notes home not to teach your kids the standard algorithm.
Right. Well, I know in our school district, there was a period of time where if the kid used the standard algorithm, even if they got the answer correct, it would be marked wrong. And
right,
so,
right.
You know, and eventually the parents got so upset that the district came out and said, if they get the right answer, you kind of have to count it as right. But that was a huge issue because, like you said, it confuses the child. And so the parent says, okay, wait, forget all that. Let me show you how to do it. And then there's that, the kid says, yeah, but Mrs. So-and-so told me, you know, and so there's that we're creating a rift between the parent and the child, and the kid isn't learning it, and the parent's trying to help. And it's just, you know, and we've been doing this with the Common Core standards were adopted in my state 10 years ago. Pioneer Institute came out with a study, it's been all over my Facebook feed about this historic drop in test scores in both reading and math since we adopted Common Core. And that was like the one change in education. And when I read that, it's like, well, I wasn't surprised. Were you surprised?
No, I wasn't surprised. And I'm glad you brought that up. I think what we're talking about, you know, this whole idea of, oh, you must understand before you're allowed to do the procedure, predates Common Core.
Oh, yeah.
As I said, you know, they have been disparaging what came before for many years. But I think Common Core essentially codified the reform math ideology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was all over all at once.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So now all of a sudden, you know, if you want to sell textbooks in this country, you better have one that is deemed to be aligned mm-hmm. with Common Core.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you have, as James had said, well, we can't teach the standard algorithm until fourth grade. I want to get into that a little bit.
Okay.
There's a little known fact, and I've had this verified by two of the lead writers of the Common Core Math Standards. So it was Bill McCallum and Jason Zimba. Yes, the standard algorithm for multi-digit addition and subtraction doesn't appear until the fourth grade standard. But both have said, but there's nothing that prohibits anyone from teaching it prior to that. Little known fact. They don't exactly publicize that very well.
Right.
To his credit, Jason Zimba did write an article, and it was in, I guess, one of the Fordham had published it. I can give you the link to it later, but a good article. And he essentially said, no, you could teach it before, and still people... Okay, why isn't that well known? Well, because the publishers are still not putting the standard algorithm in until the fourth grade textbooks.
Well, and it'll be tested on the fourth grade test, not the second or the third grade test for sure, right?
Yes, and not only that. If you have a textbook like Singapore Math, for example, that introduces it earlier, okay, you're not dinged for introducing it earlier. There's an organization called Ed Reports that mm-hmm. makes an assessment of whether you're aligned with Common Core or not. And so you could be deemed to be aligned with it if you introduce the standard algorithm before the fourth grade, let's say. But if you test for it, you're dinged for that.
Oh, my goodness.
Why that's the case, I don't know. It's in the publisher's guidelines that came out, I guess, by the Common Core people. Makes absolutely no sense. Singapore Math happens to be a pretty good program.
Yeah.
And yet they're not deemed to be aligned with Common Core.
Well, and the irony, what I'm seeing is that as test scores go down, then the school districts come back and they're trying to adopt more Common Core aligned curriculum in order to increase the test scores. And so we're kind of doubling down. We adopted Common Core. It's not working. And so now we're going to go back and we're going to find something even more in line with Common Core so it will continue to not work.
Yes. And that's the thing that keeps being repeated. Well, oh, we must not be doing it right.
Yeah.
No,
it's the implementation.
It right. That's the reason why. And I think that the philosophy is that the understanding has to precede the procedure.
Mm-hmm.
There's this thought that, if you teach the standard algorithm too early, it's going to eclipse the understanding. And we've seen from the older textbooks that certainly isn't the case. And as James had alluded to, they taught the standard algorithm first, and then later alternate strategies that they're now teaching first.
Mm-hmm. So we've inverted it.
Once you have the anchor in place with the standard algorithms, you're then more familiar with how to calculate things, and then you could be more receptive to different ways of doing it. And that's the way I had learned it. I looked at my old textbooks, and I see the making tens method,
mm-hmm.
which got a lot of press a few years ago.
Right.
What is this? What is this making tens business? Well, it's been around for many years. It's just that when it was introduced is different.
When you're familiar with numbers and how they work, you eventually get around to finding those strategies on your own. I mean,
exactly.
That's what I do, but nobody taught it to me explicitly, but I did have to learn that, 6 + 4 is 10 and everything else in there, right? And then over time you go, if I do this, this will be easier.
Yeah, the understanding comes from the procedure and doing it and practicing.
Mm-hmm.
And I liken it to being a traveler in a new city. And you've probably done this. When you're learning your way around, you have this one main street and one main route, and you go that route.
That's
the way you do it. And then somebody says, well, you could do this. No, I don't want to know that right now.
Uh-huh.
Right? You just kind of block it up. Well, after you've been there for a week, you suddenly discover, hey, if I took this shortcut and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, all these things that people have been telling you make sense, but
right.
you had to get familiar with the main method first.
Yeah, where is the Walmart? Where is the drugstore?
Yeah. And this is what it's referred to as cognitive overload, that when a kid is first learning something, they can only process a little bit at a time. And it's the same type of thing I just described. No, don't tell me this now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not ready to hear it. Or the other phenomenon, if you're in a situation when you're driving and there's something complicated going on and the radio's on, you turn down the volume, right?
Yeah, too many inputs,
thought process.
Uh-huh.
That's cognitive overload. And that brings up the whole thing about connections. The other thing that reformers say is we want kids to make the connections and to get all this understanding. Well, if you teach all these connections all at once, they're not going to get any of them. You have to leave some foundation
mm-hmm.
and build on that, and the connections come once you master these facts and you can put them together over time. The classic example is proportions, and you probably learned in seventh grade. Well, if you drive 30 miles in 2 hours, how many miles are you going to drive in 6 hours? You go 30 over 2 equals X over 6. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's disparaged. That's called answer getting. As if getting the answer is this terrible thing. And
right. Wouldn't want to get the answer,
we don't
right?
we don't want kids to just get the answers. We want them to understand. And so what they do, okay, in the past it was you learn this method where you set up the proportion. Later on in algebra you learn something called direct variation and constant of proportionality and how you could write an equation. And instead of using a proportion, you can come up with a formula. And that was built upon this foundation that you got in seventh grade. Now they do it all at once in seventh grade. So I've had to teach kids, this is called the constant proportionality. And remember we did this proportion the other day? Well, you don't have to do that. You could do this equation. I'm telling you, and I'm teaching like in an accelerated seventh grade class, even the brightest students get lost. They're just not ready.
Well, it's what you're saying, so, the overload, right? You just master one concept at a time, and then once I've got it, then I can build on it. And,
right.
I mean, I've seen this with my daughter when she was learning how to read. You teach them the phonics and you don't start out teaching them that A says A and A. You just teach them A first and you give them all those short vowel words first. Because when you put it on that silent E and you're all of a sudden, if they don't have that mastered, that blows their mind. Well, now what does A say? Well, I don't really know anymore. I think people understand that innately with reading. But we don't understand that it's the same thing with every concept, and especially math.
That's right, yeah.
It seems like it's across the board. People generally don't like what's going on. They recognize their kids are struggling. The kids are not feeling confident in math. And yet, the same powers that be keep pushing in these programs that apparently don't work. Is there, do you have any insights? What do we do? How do we fix it?
People I work with that are on the same wavelength have been hitting our heads against the wall. James and I had wrote comments on the Common Core. It was back in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And now he and I are both saying the same thing. Looks like Common Core is here to stay. It mm-hmm. looks like despite all the groups that are pushing against it, saying we don't want Common Core anymore, even the states that say, okay, we're doing away with it, all they do is rebrand it. They
right.
tweak a little bit here and there, but it's essentially the same thing. As to how to change it, I'm part of this organization, or I take part in this organization called Research Ed, which had its origins in the UK, grassroots teachers organization that holds conferences. They're not doing it now because of the worldwide shutdown, but
right.
they have conferences all over the world, just starting in the U.S. in the last few years, bringing speakers who have done research, and I mean real, honest-to-God research, good peer-reviewed studies, and what is an effective practice, and what's going on cognitively, and they have cognitive scientists. Dan Willingham is written quite a bit about this, and he's written a few books on education. He's one of the people who participates in this.
Mm-hmm.
We're hoping that there's a groundswell of, hey, here's some research, and here's what it says, and here are effective ways of teaching, and this should be the way that it's done, and hoping that that catches on.
Mm-hmm.
To do that, you have to permeate the ed schools, and that has proved to be difficult. I would say we keep trying and try to
make
yeah,
research, don't ever give up.
Available. One person who she was a speaker at this conference last year in Vancouver, and she's given a lot of talks, Barb Oakley. She's written books. One of them is Learning How to Learn. And she gets into the whole cognitive science of learning and wrote this article in the New York Times about how practice is essential in math.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, did she get a lot of flack about that. the people on the reform side said, well, can't listen to this. This is just the same old stuff that's the reason why math hasn't worked.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're fighting against. Even the best research comes up against this barrier, people who are not ready to accept it.
I always liken it to learning music theory is very interesting, and it may give me greater understanding of why a composer chose to, go from this chord to that chord to the other chord. And it would help me if I'm composing. But if I'm trying to play a piece, I'm Beethoven, Mozart, whatever, at some point I have to sit down in front of the piano and I have to practice. And I'm not going to get the more music theory, the more understanding of why this note goes to that note isn't going to make one bit of difference in my ability to actually perform the piece. But if I'm performing
that's right.
the piece, I may understand better the theory behind it as I'm doing it, right? and we understand practice in sports and in music and even in reading. Why don't we understand it in math?
Well, I absolutely agree. I think the one analogy, a person who you probably should interview, Eric Kalenz, who's written a few books, and he gave me this example, so I credit him with this. He played football. He said that the coach would give them these practice routines, do it this way, do it this way. They didn't understand the theory, the why, but they understood, okay, we practice this way, catching the ball this way, throwing it this way, getting into this position and all that. It wasn't later, until later, that when he was coaching, that he understood, oh, this is why you do it. He understood the theory behind it.
Behind it.
When he was a player, all he knew is, well, let's keep doing it. We're winning ball games.
Right. <You know? laughs>
But you're not necessarily going to understand the fine points of the theory. It's this iterative process, as I said, between procedure and understanding, and it comes with time and with practice.
And you mentioned Dan Willingham. He mentions that it's not you do one and then the other. It's kind of an overlapping, that you get the practice and a little bit more of the theory, and there's not a discrete, you know, dividing line between them.
They work in tandem. Uh-huh. That is absolutely correct.
Do you have any advice to parents or teachers?
To the parents who are able to teach their kids math at home, don't get intimidated and not teach them the standard algorithm. It's okay if you do, but you also want to give them enough ammunition so that they can do it the way the teacher is telling them, so that they get credit on tests, so mm-hmm. forth, if that game is being played. But as far as what the parents should do, the way they learned it is not a bad way, even though they're being told, oh, the way you learned it is old-fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents are on the right track. If you're able to teach your kid standard algorithms and how to solve certain problems, go ahead and do that. The shame about it is that in areas where low-income areas where maybe parents are not able to do this, or they're not able to afford tutors, those kids are at a disadvantage. They're
right.
at the mercy of whatever the school is teaching them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I find to be inequitable.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, in my opinion, a big problem. The solution to it, I'm not sure what the solution is, other than to keep pushing the research that's out there, the people that are writing these books, the Dan Willinghams, the Barbara Oakleys, Eric Collins, people like that. Get these books in the hands of teachers, people who could make a difference within the schools.
And hopefully there
will
be a change.
Over time, hopefully things will start to change. I'm hopeful of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are probably more people around like me who are doing this as a second career and who teach in a traditional manner. I know other teachers who do. So there's a few of us around, and I'm hoping that over the years there are more of us.
Mm-hmm.
So that is my hope for the future.
Yeah, that is mine too, because I know I've been worried about this for about 20 years, and it sounds like you've been worried about it for a lot longer. And we just need to keep people aware and working on it. Well, Barry, any final thoughts for our listeners?
Well, just keep your ear to the ground. Keep reading those research papers that are presenting good, effective practices. Try to get the word out as best you can. That would be my advice. I think the more people who know, the better armed we are.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Barry. I appreciate it.
This has been the Family Freedom Podcast with Wendy Hart. Follow this podcast, share with your friends and neighbors, and add to the Voices of Family and Freedom.